We're ready. All right, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Medical Care Advisory Committee. We have a pretty packed house here today for the advisory committee meeting, so welcome all of you to the Agency for Healthcare Administration. We have a very interesting agenda today, one that for the first time involves the review of marketing materials submitted by the health plans in the Managed Medical Assistance Program that the state will be rolling out over the course of this spring and summer, starting on May the 1st. Let me turn it over now to Carla Sims to do a roll call, and I think maybe we'll just go around the room and have folks introduce themselves rather than do a formal roll call, but go ahead, Carla.
Yes, we have a lot of new members to our committee, so if we'll go around the room, and those of you on the committee, please introduce yourself and tell us what organization you represent on the Medical Care Advisory Committee.
I'm Chuck Corley, Secretary of Florida Department of Elder Affairs.
We just need to speak into the microphones because we are recording this meeting, so it can be recorded for posterity as
All right.
Public record.
Thank you, Justin. Chuck Corley, Secretary of Florida Department of Elder Affairs.
I'm Robert Payne, the Florida Dental Association.
Stan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners.
I'm Charlotte Curtis, representing Dr. John Armstrong. I'm with Department of Health Children's Medical Services.
Rich Thacker, local internist here in Tallahassee, osteopathic physician representing the FOMA, but also representing the FMA, and I'm one of the original members of this committee.
I'm Michael Lockwood from Fort Lauderdale. I'm a Medicaid participant and liaison to the HIV/AIDS subpopulation subcommittee.
Courtney Smith with the Department of Children and Families, the Office of Child Welfare. I'm here on the behalf of Jennifer Lane.
Hello, I'm Amy Guinan, representing Florida Legal Services.
I'm Kathy Moffitt, representing the Florida Association of Health Plans.
And we have a number of people on the telephone. Anyone on the phone? That was Sarah Sequencia. She's one of our members.
Sunshine Health, representing the Child Welfare Program.
Dr. Jeff Martorano, Sunshine Health.
Okay. And we also have Tracy Inman and Iris Wimbush, who are members of our committee that could not be with us today. Next on the agenda is the MCAC Minutes. Those of you on the committee, you had an opportunity to review the minutes, and if you have any questions, comments at this time.
Motion to accept.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Next on the agenda is introductions of our subpopulation committees. Our first subpopulation committee is the Managed Long-Term Care. Dr. Moffitt.
Just by way of background for those in the room that are new, we divided in our last Medical Care Advisory Committee into a variety of different subpopulation committees, including one for HIV/AIDS, and there's a list here on the agenda of all the different subpopulation committees that we're going to have. This was something that we worked with our federal partner on, reaching an agreement about having these subpopulation committees so that there would be a chance for folks to have, stakeholders to have additional input into our program and to provide advice to the agency on the things that are going on in the field. In addition to that, I wanted to welcome particularly the beneficiary the beneficiary representatives on the committee. Welcome back to Tallahassee, and thank you for coming on the phone as well. That is also something that, in working with our federal partner, we've enhanced for this committee is significantly more representation on the part of beneficiaries in the Medicaid program, and that really gives terrific insight for us, or the opportunity to get great insight into how some of the initiatives that we're working on are actually affecting the population. So thank you very much. Go ahead, Dr. Moffitt.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Secretary. I'm Kathy Moffitt. I serve on the Medical Care Advisory Committee, and I'm also the liaison to the Managed Long-Term Care Subcommittee. So it's my privilege to introduce the other members of the subcommittee who are either here or not in attendance today. First, from Leading Age Florida, Bobby Bernal. I saw Bobby at the airport. He is not here today, but I think he has a representative here. Dana McHugh, thank you for being here. Holly Hohmeister from the Florida Developmental Disabilities Council, thank you. Dana McHugh from Ann Swerlick, Florida Legal Services, thank you. And Cheryl Young from DOEA. Hey, Cheryl. And I'm Kathy Moffitt. Dr. Thacker is here on the committee as well. And I don't believe Mrs. Pierce is here with us today. Martha Pierce is also a member of the Medical Care Advisory Committee and also sits on this committee, as well as from ACA supporting us, Phyllis Davis.
She's out on standing in for her summer break.
Thank you, Summer. And Kelly Walsh. Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Amy Guinan. I am the Behavioral Health and Substance Abuse MCAC representative, and I'd like to introduce the rest of our subcommittee members. We have a great group with lots of knowledge and experience in this issue. The first member, Uta Gaziak, she's with the Department of Children and Families. Okay, great. Thank you. And I believe Karen is on the phone. Karen Kutch with the Florida Council for Community Mental Health. Okay. And Celeste Putnam, representing the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. All right. And Albert Mirren, he's representing the Advocates. Great. Tracy Inman, I believe she's...
Forgive me if I don't understand something that's said, because I'm a cochlear implant user with bilateral cochlear implants, and I'm also blind. I normally depend upon sign language interpreters to communicate, but I'm doing my best with my implants today just because of the lack of transportation. I'm proud to be a member of the committee and glad that I can participate.
Great. Thank you so much, Tracy. And our ACA staff, Kimberly Houston and Heather Allman, are they here? Great. Thank you all. Thanks. And now, who's doing children, or should I?
I'll pass it to you.
You can give it to Michael Lockwood.
Okay. Hi, I'm Michael Lockwood from Fort Lauderdale, and I am on the HIV/AIDS Population Subcommittee. And I'm glad to be working with other members of the committee, including Jesse Fry. Jesse Fry from the Florida HIV/AIDS Advocacy Network. Michael Ruppel from the AIDS Institute.
He's in Washington,
D.C. Okay, thank you. And Jeff Beal from the Department of Health. Cynthia Alcius, ARNP. And from the staff, we have Melanie Brown-Woofter. And Katrina. Katrina. Hey, Katrina. Good to see you. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to sit down. I'm Dr. Robert Payne, and I am the dental care for children liaison to the committee. And... on the subcommittee, And most of them are seated directly across from me. And if you would just sort of, you know, raise your hand. We have Dr. Frank Catalanato from the University of Florida, and Ed Zappert, who is the dental director for the Department of Health. And Terry Buckenheimer is not here, and he asked Dr. Leo White to take his place. And then Tammy Miller from the Florida Dental Hygiene Association, and Sarah Sequenzia, who is a beneficiary representative.
Yes, this is Sarah. Can I help you?
Just introducing you.
Well, thank you very much. I'll go back on mute.
Okay. And then we have our AUCA staff, Erica Floyd Thomas and Tamara Zanders. All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Siobhan Harris. I'm actually here with the agency. Ellen Anderson couldn't be here today, so I'm going to introduce the MCAC members and subcommittee members for the Subcommittee on Children, including safeguards and performance measures related to foster children. The MCAC members include Ellen Anderson and Jennifer Lang. Jennifer as well couldn't be here today, but she has asked Courtney Smith from the Department of Children and Families Office of Child Welfare to come in her stead. Subcommittee members include Vary Jenkins with the Florida Federation of Families. Is Ms. Jenkins here? Okay. Sherry Castleberry.
Yes, I'm here. I'm on the conference call. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Sherry Castleberry Rowe, an ARNP. Is Ms. Castleberry Rowe here? Okay. And then we have Iris Winbush, a beneficiary representative, who could not be here. Oh, she is here. Okay, great. And then from...
One second. Ms. Winbush, you actually have a seat at the table here, so come on up.
And then... From AUCA, we have Katie Oskowitz, Lakira Reddick, and Kathleen Kaur. Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Michelle Logan. Michelle will do a presentation on the family planning waiver.
Good afternoon, everyone.
One second, but before we get started on that, I just have a couple of things that I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of since our last meeting. Our last meeting was toward the end of January, and since that time, we actually had two additional what we would call rollouts, regional rollouts for the long-term care program, the long-term care component of statewide Medicaid managed care. And now, I'm happy to say for the first time, our first meeting, the entire state, the long-term care program has been rolled out statewide. There has been a lot of communication that has gone on between the folks at this table as well as the various advocacy groups and organizations around the state that have an interest in long-term care in the state. The rollout has been incredibly successful. I think that any troubleshooting that we had, we were able to do really effectively with good communication, and we really appreciate all of the input and hard work that was put into the rollout by everyone involved. I want to particularly thank our partner at the Department of Elder Affairs, who did a fantastic job during the rollout. I think so far it's been an incredible success, at least in terms of the smoothness of the rollout. Now it's a matter of managing the program as steady state, and that's a challenge in and of itself. And we're going to be relying on continued communication with all of the various stakeholders in the room to do that. So. Thank you. Thank you, Secretary Corley, for all your hard work, and thank you to everyone in the room for that. In addition, I just wanted to let everyone know that the medical assistance portion of the statewide Medicaid managed care program is imminent to roll out, and it's going to start rolling out in the region of the state that runs essentially from Panama City down to Ocala. It includes Daytona Beach, Jacksonville, Gainesville, Ocala, Tallahassee, and Panama City. That rollout is going to happen on May the 1st. We actually opened the phone lines as well as the website for folks to enroll in the plan, the health plan of their choice around the state in those regions in mid-February. So far we found that we had the capacity in the phone lines, and we've had the capacity on the website for folks to make a choice, and that we have had good call volume and handled a steady volume of choice. The 60-day choice period for folks in those regions actually closed over the weekend, and we did our monthly plan assignments, what we call monthly magic, and delivered the assignments to the plans over the weekend and on Monday. So once the folks are in those plans, they are not locked in for an entire year. They have 90 days to test the plan out, kick the tires, see how it works, see if they're happy with it, and can change plans during that 90-day period for any reason at all, good reason, bad reason, no reason. They're free agents. And so we do encourage folks who haven't already selected, if you find yourself in a plan that you're unhappy with, you do have the opportunity to call our choice counselor. You do have the opportunity to switch plans. The phone lines are now currently open for the Miami and Fort Lauderdale area. They just opened for that, so that's the two largest population centers in the state, the two most culturally challenging in terms of there being the most languages spoken and things like that. We do have the ability to handle all of those calls in three different languages, I think live in three different languages, and in about 60 or 70 other languages via interpreters. So we can answer the phone in Spanish, Creole, or English, and we can also have interpreters on hand for 60 or 70 additional languages in those regions. We're also live in the Tampa Bay area, Tampa and St. Pete, as well as down the west coast of Florida. In terms of the phone lines, the folks in Tampa will be joining their health plans on the 1st of June, and the folks in the Miami-Fort Lauderdale area will be joining their plans, as well as the Keys, will be joining their plans on July the 1st. We intend to finish the rollout statewide on August the 1st. If there are any problems, if you're hearing anything on the ground as an advocacy organization, as a recipient, as a stakeholder like the Florida Hospital Association or the Florida Association of Health Plans or the various medical associations and professional associations, bad news does not get better with age. Give us a call. Let us know that something is going wrong, and we will make sure that we make it right and make it right immediately. And there's going to be a little bit of a discussion from Kristen Sokolowski from ACA a little bit later about how we have centralized the intake on issues so that they go into one place, can be triaged, and can be resolved as quickly as possible. It's something we developed for the long-term care enrollment that worked very well, and we're going to be adapting it and using it again for the medical assistance enrollment. Stan.
Is the question that my members have been asking me is with the influx of 300,000 or 250,000, I think it was, people who've been added into the Medicaid program because of the rollout with the ACA, is that going to affect anything that we've got planned, or is that going to tax our system, or are we prepared to take those numbers on? I mean, those are the questions I'm getting. Yeah.
Thank you for that question. The projections around the Medicaid program in the state of Florida are made by something called the Social Services Estimating Conference. They were aware that there was a possibility for what we call a surge in eligible but not enrolled people to, because of the opening of the exchanges and the federal exchanges, would enroll in our system for the first time. The actual enrollment surge that we saw was in line with the projections that the Social Services Estimating Conference made, so they were in line with the projections in the state of Florida. They have been budgeted for, and so we are ready for them. If you are a health plan, we have certain ratios that those plans are required to meet from a network adequacy standpoint, and of course, the more people that come into our system, the more members the health plan has, and the larger its network is required to be under the network adequacy standards. So we will be policing and monitoring that as an agency. In addition, we had to make sure that our phone lines and our website could handle the influx so that there were choice counselors available to help those folks as they came into our system choose the new plans. And we do believe that we have the capacity for that, and we believe that they're going to be integrated into our system smoothly. if you're hearing anything to the contrary, if you're hearing any difficulty, anyone out there, not just Mr. Whitaker, but anybody out there hearing any difficulty, if anyone's having trouble enrolling, we'll make sure we can actually have the ability to send that person a face-to-face choice counselor to help them enroll. So anybody that's having any particular difficulty, we do have the capacity right now to do things like that. Just let us know.
I knew that we had talked about that, and I was just wondering how that, when that surge came, if we were able to. I know we had planned for that. We talked about that in numerous discussions here. So thank you for updating us.
Do you know the number? How many new enrollments
you've
had? I have a question.
Our enrollment numbers are up near the 3.5 million per month range, and they were down closer to the 3.3 million per month back in the early fall. Now, we expected some growth in our program just naturally as a result of the population growing and otherwise, so the exact number that we believe is associated with the exchanges, I'm not sure. It would be somewhere between, it would be somewhere probably under 200,000, but probably more than 50,000. But it did seem to us that our actual enrollment, the total enrollment, which was projected by the Social Services Estimating Conference, we are in the green, is how we would put it in terms of the projection. So we're in a good place with respect to that projection, which means they've budgeted enough money for us to serve that population.
Do we know how many of those new enrollees were previously uninsured?
I don't. I think there's going to be, now that the Affordable Care Act has been rolled out in its initial phase, I think there now is going to be some time for everyone really to study the actual effects of the rollout, to understand what the relative age of the population is that enrolled on the various health plans on the exchange, what the population looks like that came into the Medicaid programs, both in expansion and in non-expansion states, and there's going to be a lot of analysis of that data going forward, but I think it's just a little too early to tell right now. So I'm sorry, I don't have a clear.
Including how many adults enrolled. How many adults enrolled?
Correct. Adults. And then the relative age of those adults also can be a critical factor in the way that commercial plans set their rates. I understand there was a question from the phone.
Sir, I have a question. You mentioned interpreters, and I am wondering, how are you planning on reaching the deafblind population? I realize that this is such a low incidence population, but given that this is Florida and it's a retirement state, as people become older, their hearing and sight degenerate with age, and there is also quite a number of younger folks who are deaf and blind from their disabilities. I'm wondering how we will reach these people for the enrollment plan.
I'm going to hand the microphone over to David Rogers.
Good afternoon. It's a very good question. It's one of the areas that I think has been a real challenge for us to do. As Justin mentioned, kind of the face-to-face, we do have the ability, we have capacity for choice counselors out in the field that can meet with individuals personally. We have, and they do a lot of work with local community groups. I think we've been challenged in kind of connecting those in terms of leveraging those local groups and community groups to actually get to individuals, but we do have that capacity with the staff and contracted resources that we have out in the field to do choice counseling. So I think we'd be, you know, very interested in to hear, again, better ways to make that connection and use some of those local resources that have the capability to do that very enhanced one-on-one counseling to actually find and connect with all types of individuals that may have some special considerations.
Well, perhaps what could be done is consider adding a support service program, Medicaid waiver, to provide support service providers to people who are deafblind on Medicaid that would help them with things such as filling out applications for Humana or other Medicaid supplement programs in the state of Florida, and facilitating communication, providing transportation, mobility insight and guide, it is almost similar to a caregiver, except the client makes all the decisions, and the provider is simply acting as the eyes and the ears to the deafblind. There are other states that already have support service provider programs in place and are using Medicaid waivers in those states. I do know that the Independent Living Resource Center is just now talking about trying to find the data and resources to start a program for the deafblind. Vocational Rehabilitation in Tallahassee has also began talking about support service providers. They recently hired a deafblind specialist to coordinate services between the clients and the vocational rehabilitation.
Thank you very much for that input. I can assure you that our agency does remain committed to making sure that all of our recipients, no matter what their condition, have the opportunity to understand the choices that are available to them and make the choice that is best for them. And so we're more than willing to entertain all sorts of options that make sense for our recipients to help connect them with the services that they need. So I do appreciate that, and I think this is a dialogue that we definitely need to continue. And it's one example of why it's very important to have beneficiary representatives on this committee. So thank you very much for that.
Good afternoon, everyone. The agency is in the process right now of requesting a 3-year extension of one of the 1115 waivers, which is referred to as the Florida Medicaid Family Planning Waiver. And as I go through the slides, I'm going to give you a little bit of information about the existing waiver, the extension, and some of the requirements. And at the end, you'll have an opportunity to ask any questions that you might have about any of those issues. The existing waiver was actually initially awarded to the agency in 1998 for a 5-year period. The years following that were for a 3-year period, and the existing waiver that we have right now that's current was awarded July 1st, 2011, and it is active through December 31st, 2014, which is this year. And that includes an automatic 1-year extension that was granted by CMS. And that's across the board. It wasn't specific to Florida. It was across the board for all states that had the family planning waivers. The 1115 research and demonstration waivers vary in the types. They're experimental, pilot, and demonstration projects. The family planning waiver is a demonstration project. And there are a couple of different categories with the 1115 waivers. However, each category does give us the opportunity to provide limited services to recipients that are outside of the Medicaid requirements. And each one of those, beyond the 5-year initial award, is for 3 years. Waiver extension requirements include a public notice document that should be posted for 30 days that allows stakeholders to ask questions, provide comments, give information that we may need. And our public notice document was posted, and the posting period is April 1st through April 30th, and that is that's available for viewing on the link that's provided. And anyone is able to send in comments or questions via an email address, which is also provided here, or they can send them directly to me, Michelle Logan, at 2727 Mahan Drive, mail stop 20, Tallahassee, Florida, 32308. Each one of the extension demonstrations do have a public notice document that there are requirements involved with the public notice document. And for each one of them, there are 8 requirements, and they involve providing a description, goals, and objectives of the demonstration, the eligibility requirements involved with the demonstration, an expected increase or decrease in annual enrollment involved with the demonstration, hypothesis and evaluation for the actual demonstration, expenditures and authorities involved, and also, just as I mentioned, the public notice document
locations and internet addresses for public viewing, and also email addresses and postal service address for sending in those questions for a minimum of 30 days, just as I described. We are also required to hold two public meetings, and this is one of the first public meetings, and I will tell you a little bit more about the second one a little bit later. There are also elements of this particular waiver that we are required to supply in our extension request, and it's a summary of the demonstration project, compliance with the special terms and conditions with the existing waiver, waiver and expenditure authorities, quality activities under the waiver, compliance with budget neutrality, and we also need to report on the evaluation activities that have been conducted thus far. And as I mentioned earlier, the public notice document must be noted in the extension request, and we must show compliance with the public notice document. The current waiver program is offered in all 67 counties to women ages 14 through 55 and have an income level at or below 85% and are not otherwise eligible for Medicaid or other types of insurance. The eligibility is for a two-year period, and they must reapply after the first year. The overarching goal of the demonstration is we would like to increase the number of women that are actually receiving these services. And we have four objectives that we're working toward in terms of that. We'd like to increase access to family planning services. We'd like to increase child spacing intervals, reduce the number of unattended pregnancies, and also reduce the cost of the Medicaid as a result of the unattended pregnancies. Through the family planning waiver, recipients have a variety of services that are available. Although they're limited, they do have a list that are available. They have physical exams, family planning counseling and pregnancy tests, birth control supplies, treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, and related drugs and laboratory tests. In order to be eligible for family planning waiver for the second year, a recipient must fill out an application that is sent in to Department of Health. And this is just a copy of the application so that you can see what it looks like. As far as the impact of the family planning waiver on other areas of Medicaid, there is no impact on Medicaid or other programs. It just allows the agency to provide, as I described, limited services to women that are in need of family planning services. As I mentioned earlier, there are requirements associated with public comment and public document. We had the public notice document posted April 1st, and it's available through April 30th, and stakeholders may provide comments and questions during that time. As I mentioned earlier, we will be holding two meetings that is required. One is today here at this meeting, and the second one will be on Thursday, April 24th, at the Medicaid Area Office 6 in Tampa, Florida, and anyone is welcome to join that meeting as well. We'll have a conference call. People can call in, and there is a link here that you can access if you want more information concerning that meeting. Does anybody have any questions regarding the existing waiver or the extension or the requirements? Yes.
Thank you so much for the presentation. I do have one question.
Okay.
As we all work to try to improve birth outcomes and maternal health, one
right.
particular challenge becomes trying to improve inter-pregnancy health.
Yes.
And when women who qualify for Medicaid because they are pregnant then lose Medicaid eligibility after a six-week postpartum
right.
check, this looks like a wonderful opportunity to reach out to those women who are at 185% of federal poverty or below and say, hey, you can maintain and have an opportunity to improve interpregnancy health by availing yourself of these services. Are there targeted outreach Is there targeted outreach to pregnant women to advise them of the availability of this service?
I can tell you this. We are working closely with the evaluation group within the agency, and they are working closely with Department of Health and asking the county health departments what challenges that they're encountering in some of these areas. So we are trying to nail down some of the ways that we can reach out to these people a little more effectively. Yes, we do already provide outreach as well. No. Regarding the public comment period?
Michelle,
no.
If you could repeat his question.
I'm sorry?
I just asked if you received any written comments.
No, not as of yet. Have I received any comments regarding the extension request via the email or mail, through the mail? And no, I have not.
Dr. Thacker, so you have a 30-day, basically I'm going over the elements of the public notice document, and so through postal or internet email,
yeah,
comments can be submitted and reviewed by the public for a minimum of 30 days.
That's correct. That's
and
correct.
You have a minimum of two meetings that you need to hold. You selected the April 1st to the end of April, right, as your 30-day.
Yes.
Yet the two meetings are at the end of the month. I think that it may have been a little better, and I know it's after the fact here, but it may have been a little better to have the meetings earlier so that there was more access of the public and by the public in order to generate those comments that you're looking for. So your second meeting is in 2 days from now. And so, and then the opportunity to submit questions then closes.
Okay. Well,
in a few days,
we will certainly make note of that and consider that for the next extension request.
And
thank you for your comment.
That's basically what I'm saying is maybe you
right.
should extend that a little bit
sure.
for public comment.
Okay. Thank you.
One thing I would like to add to that is that in fact we're always open for public comment, and so we have a dialogue as we negotiate these waivers and as we try to apply to renew these waivers with the federal government. We have a dialogue with them, and we try to make sure that every comment that we received, whether it's in the formal in the notice and for public comment period, whether it's comments that are received at this meeting, we try to summarize those comments and deliver them to the federal government. I think that it's fair to say also that the federal government never has a closed comment period.
Mm-hmm.
So you can always talk to them, and I think there are certain groups that would prefer to talk to them versus talking to us, and that's fair enough. I think that mm-hmm. that's totally appropriate to talk to them as our partner. Feel free to do that as well. So anybody that has any comments that you'd like to share with us or with them or both, I think it's fair to say we're never closed for public comment.
I think that's exactly the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Payne, on slide number 7, you talk about the age range being from 14 to 55.
Yes.
And I was wondering how you decide upon those ages. For sadly, 14 may be a little late to be starting,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also thinking 55 may be a little bit old to be continuing.
Mm-hmm. Well, based on the research that's been done, it has been determined that that's a good age range, and it does cover a big span of eligible people that may become pregnant. We feel like we've covered a good coverage.
Sure. But we're happy to take that comment under advisement and go back and look at the data. And if we need to revisit that span, we will do so. Okay.
Any other questions? Comments?
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Sokolowski, and I'm going to talk a little bit today about our centralized complaint and issue tracking that we have developed with the implementation of the statewide Medicaid managed care program. Mainly, I want to familiarize you with the online submission of complaints that we have established and make sure that you are familiar with how you can submit any issues and comments that you have to the agency. As you know, we're moving toward the full implementation of SMMC, and before we began the long-term care component of the program, we established a centralized complaint and issue operations center in our Fort Myers office. The goal of the center was to increase the experience of staff handling various issues or complaints from providers, constituents, or advocates, and to increase our efficiency on handling and triaging any issues received by centralizing the operation of those centers. As I mentioned, our centralized complaint hub has its lead staff located in our Fort Myers office in our Area 8 office. They're responsible for intake, resolution, and tracking of all complaints or issues related to the statewide Medicaid managed care program. I'm here today presenting on this because the lead staff person in charge of this effort, Deatra Cole, who is our Area 8 field office manager, could not be here today. And I know that we hope to bring her up to one of your future meetings so that she can give you even more information about the process. The Area 8 office is responsible for the intake, resolution, and tracking, but we have staff throughout the state who have been trained to handle the intake of and resolution of issues and complaints regarding the program. And so far, our experience in the long-term care program has been that it's definitely increased our ability to quickly respond to any issues received from the public, from recipients and providers and other advocates. Some typical sources of complaints or issues include Medicaid recipients, healthcare providers, family members or authorized representatives of recipients, other state agencies, advocacy groups or legislative members and staff. And just to take a moment to clarify, what we're tracking and handling through this hub is not just formal complaints. It's any issue that a provider or a recipient has with the program of any level, any issue that's come to the attention of an advocacy group or a legislative staff member or anybody who has a concern or a question about how the program's operating or impacting their constituency. We've been working very hard through the outreach we're doing around the SMMC program to really encourage people to use this whenever they have any issue, big, small. We don't want people to feel hesitant in submitting an issue or complaint to the hub. In fact, one of the changes that we've made through the course of implementing the long-term care program is we've altered the online form so that people can submit an issue anonymously. We did hear during the course of the long-term care program, some providers particularly were hesitant to submit a complaint. They didn't want, you know, a health plan to think that they were complaining about them, and so we've changed the form so people can submit them anonymously so that they can make us aware of any issues. We can work on them without having to know the provider or recipient's name. So that's a new function I think just went live 2 or 3 weeks ago. The next couple slides just have an example of the type of issues that we expect to see and that we do see. We see issues relating to the receipt of services, including people who need additional services or want to make a complaint about the quality of their services. We see issues relating to service providers. Providers will contact us if they're having problems getting paid or getting prior authorizations, or if they want to have more information about how to contract with the health plans, they'll submit issues and complaints through this centralized hub. In the long-term care program, particularly, we did see issues submitted that had to do with eligibility, people having incorrect county codes or addresses in their file that caused them to either get welcome letters for different regions than the one they lived in or have some issues with enrollment. We were able to track and handle those through the complaint hub as well. Okay. I'm going to just walk you through quickly the actual form and how to submit a complaint. You can go to our website to find the complaint online complaint form. You can see here when you get to the main statewide Medicaid managed care page, there's a button, report a complaint, and that's actually on several pages throughout the SMMC portion of our website, so it should be always easy to find. You just click on that button. Once you do, it'll bring up an online form like you see on the screen here. Yolanda and my staff was nice enough to fill this one out with her information. So, and as you can see, there's a field for your name, your email address, and your phone number. When it says your name, email, and phone number, that is the person submitting the issue. So if you're doing it on behalf of someone else, you put your name there, and then you put the recipient or provider details down in the bottom half. And we can walk through the next couple slides for more about the form. Again, you can put your name, email, and phone number. That's requested to help us assist you. But if you wish to remain anonymous, you do not have to do that. You, of course, the more information you provide in the form, the more likely we are to be able to help you quickly. So put as much information as you can. If you want to remain anonymous, just put as much detail as you have. You can submit the complaint form on behalf of yourself or on behalf of another, as I previously mentioned. There is a slot on the form for your email address. As you know, the email address is public record under Florida law, so if you don't want to include that, you don't have to. Also, if you are unable to or have difficulties with filling out the form online, or if you're working with someone who's having difficulties, you don't have to submit to the Complaint Hub through the online form. You can send an email. You can also contact our area offices, and they'll take down your information on the phone and enter it into our tracking system themselves. One thing that we're trying to do is really get everything to go through this system. So whenever other parts of the agency or the division are receiving information about providers or recipients who have issues or complaints, we're all entering them into the system so that we have a centralized tracking. It's really helped us see trends of things that are going on during the implementation and helped us keep ahead of any kind of issues that were coming up. The next slide just walks you through the other fields that are in the online form. We try to have drop-down menus to make it easier for you as you move through. Again, you can select the type of issue that you have, or we have a free text box that allows you to enter in any information that you have about the issue. One thing that's come to our attention recently with the online complaint form is that it has a maximum character limit of about 2,000, which is usually large enough to accommodate anybody. But if you're working with constituents or you yourself want to submit a form and you get an error message, it may be related to the size of the information that you're trying to enter. So that's the one recent development we've had with moving to MMA. Some of the issues are longer or the narrative's longer, so more detailed. So it's been hitting up against that. One of the main things, especially for someone who's working for an advocacy organization or working with a recipient or provider, is if you want to be contacted to know the outcome of the issue, there's a box you check on the form saying, yes, please have someone contact me with the outcome. If not, they'll work directly with the recipient or provider that's listed in the issue form, and they won't necessarily contact you. So check that box if you want to have a follow-up from staff. So that's generally just an overview of the form and how you can use it. Like I said, we've been working very hard to make sure that everyone involved with the Medicaid program on the outside and the inside knows that we really want you to submit any questions you have to this hub. We don't want anybody to hesitate. We're glad to have everything come in there. So we encourage you to use it and to work with any of the providers or recipients you have contact with every day.
It's really important that everybody feel comfortable, maybe even going online to check out this system and get themselves comfortable with it, whether you're going to file or help someone fill out a complaint, or whether you have an issue that you want to bring to our attention. If you contact us, we're probably going to use this system to log your complaint anyway. So you can short circuit that by going directly into our complaint hub and log these issues on your own. As we've done this rollout, similar to the way that we did long-term care, we have taken great pains to try to define exactly what a successful rollout will look like. And we have come up with four key components that we're going to be looking for as this program rolls out. The first is continuity of care, which is actually the same as in long-term care. We want folks, if they're undergoing an ongoing course of treatment, that course of treatment should continue with their existing provider. That includes pregnancy, if that's their ongoing course, with their existing provider, regardless of whether their existing provider is under contract with their new managed care plan or not. that managed care plan is going to be obligated, even if they're out of network, to pay that provider and make sure that that provider is reimbursed for their services. But we do want continuity of care. We have specific continuity of care provisions around pharmacy and several other things. We'd be open to discussing with any of you what those specifics are. But it is very important that folks that are undergoing certain treatments or that have been getting drugs for a long period of time, the same type of drug, that they are able to maintain their course of treatment. One other thing also is we expect the managed care plans in our system to have very broad and accurate networks, broader than anything that we've ever had before in our system. And so if you are seeing or recipients are seeing or any advocacy groups are seeing that the networks that are being put out there by the plans aren't accurate or someone who is purported to be in the network actually isn't, it's important that you let us know that. This is our opportunity through this hub to identify whether issues are a one-off or whether issues are specific to a region or specific to a plan or specific to our agency, something our agency has done that's an error. This is how we can identify whether problems are isolated or whether they're systemic, and it gives us an opportunity to correct them as fast as possible. I've given you two, continuity of care and broad, accurate networks. The other is that providers need to be paid promptly by the plans for their services. So if any provider organizations, the provider organizations here at the table, very important that you understand that if your providers are not getting paid, that we understand that that is happening, so that we can get a jump on exactly what's going on and make sure that they get paid for the services that they render. We don't want anybody missing their payroll as a result of the rollout of this program. It's very important to us. And the last is on us, and that's the ability to meet our service level agreements with our website and with our choice counseling to make sure that folks can get through and make the choices they need to make. So far, that has been happening. The next 30 to 40 days are probably going to be the busiest in our system because Tampa and St. Pete and Miami and Fort Lauderdale are all, the phone lines are open, and we are open for business in all four of those areas. So extremely large, culturally complex areas of the state that we're taking on all at one time. So if you're having any trouble getting through, it's important that we understand what's going on so that we can make the corrections we need to make.
Yes. This is great. I'm glad to see this. And being able to file a complaint or gives you peace of mind and knowing that there may be some kind of hurdle here you have to cross or somewhere else where the problem can be solved. But I guess my question is, once we get all these complaints, do we have a system or a setup to review, and not just to meet them every complaint individually, but look at maybe systematic problems or things? Do we have someone or to handle all these complaints and make the services better?
Yeah. As
order, sure. Through the chair, for the benefit of those on the telephone, when someone begins to speak, introduce yourself so they know who's there.
Sure. That was Michael Lockwood, beneficiary representative, and this is Justin again. The answer to your question is yes. We have our folks. We have historically run a number of different programs side by side and a number of different delivery systems side by side. We are going now to a single delivery system, this statewide Medicaid managed care program. Because of the way we were organized before with a number of different programs side by side, depending on what program you're in, that's how you would complain. And there were a number of different avenues that would end up in different silos within our agency as to how you would get a complaint to us. Because we're now running one program, we do have the opportunity to have a single complaint hub. And that's how we are reorganizing ourselves so that our area office in Area 8, and you don't have to dial long distance to get to Fort Myers, you'll have the ability either through the web or through a toll-free number to get through to them. They are the ones that are responsible for tracking these complaints. So they are all logged. Every single one is logged, and then its resolution is tracked and closed out. And we do have people down there that do study the complaints as they come in to see whether we're seeing something consistent by plan or by region or by something that the agency has done that has had an effect on the population so that we can figure out whether something is a one-off or whether something is something that has to be dealt with systemically, either by talking to a health plan or by talking to all the plans in a region. We have, in the long-term care program, we actually had the ability to make outbound phone calls to the population because it was a smaller population. We will probably do that in a very targeted way with MMA. But when you look at the issues that are subject to complaints from Kristen's presentation, and you look at the types of people and entities that can make those complaints, I think I hope the takeaway is that anybody can complain. Anybody can raise an issue. It's important to us that everybody feel comfortable raising issues with us, and that everybody knows that they're not going to be retaliated against for bringing issues to us. They can do it anonymously if they're not comfortable. But everybody should feel comfortable raising issues to us, and everything is an issue potentially. On the outbound calls in long-term care, the neighbor's corgis barking too much. We got that complaint. There was very little we could do about it, but there's a sympathetic ear for you. You know, but there were all sorts of things that would come up, but nothing, any issue that you have that you want to bring to our attention, if you don't say anything, then we can't solve it for you. But if you bring it to our attention, there's all sorts of things potentially that we can bring to bear to make sure that you are satisfied and that it is taken care of.
This is Kristen Sokolowski again. Also, I wanted to let everyone know that, as I mentioned before, Diatra Cole is the field office manager in charge of this program, and we are more than happy to bring her back up in the next meeting that you have to go over more with you some of the analysis that they have done on the types of issues that were received. Also, that we do have routine updates from the Complaint Hub staff on what's being received, and management and other staff that's responsible for implementing this program has been getting those reports daily throughout the program implementation. We use them as a tool to help us change things, you know, from one region to another if we've seen any trends. So it's really been a very valuable tool for us in implementing the program. In long-term care, we used it a lot to kind of just change our direction a little bit to make things smoother as we went through the transition.
Every issue that's raised to us gives us an opportunity to make the program better, to make the rollout better. So everybody really sincerely needs to feel comfortable bringing issues to our attention.
This is Charlotte Curtis. I too think this is a great mechanism to identify issues and look at trends as the complaints come in. What is the method in which you'll use to communicate with the health plans or other state agencies in which complaints are about so that you can get to the root issues and so that we can all work collaboratively together to address these issues statewide?
Charlotte, this is Kristen Sokolowski again. I can answer that. During our implementation, we have routine meetings with all of the contract managers for each of the health plans, and they are kept informed of all the issues and complaints that are coming in. They see the trends in the summary reports, and I think it's really created an atmosphere where, you know, there's been a lot of movement toward correcting any issues that come up. So we continue to share all of the information, the trends, the statistics that we get through the hub with each of the health plans.
Is there ways to send in those complaints if a recipient has a complaint and is unable to access the complaint line hotline by telephone? Is there a way to email or use e-communications to file these complaints?
Yes, ma'am. This is Kristen Sokolowski again. Any issues or complaints from external parties or even just questions about the program can be emailed to our email address, which is flmedicaidmanagedcare@aca.myflorida.com. Also, when you go on our website, there's a big button for submitting comments and questions, so you don't have to remember the email address. So if you can't access the form or if you have difficulty using the phone to contact the field office, you can send an email. And, of course, a hard copy letter is perfectly acceptable as well. Anything that we receive that's a complaint or an issue, we will get it through the system, so you don't have to worry about the format if you have any difficulties using the online form.
We appear to have had a question from the audience.
My voice was pretty loud, so I was surprised. Cindy Meredith, Prestige Health Choice. My question was, the complaints will flow to the contract managers. Is that what I'm understanding? And would they be coming from the hub, or will they be coming from the area offices? Because now they come in from everywhere, so I was just curious in terms of that process.
This is David Rogers. Let me kind of clarify. There's a couple of different levels of involvement from staff that are going on in terms of what we talked about. So every single issue or complaint, the individual instance, is dealt with by staff, either from the complaint hub or the local field staff that are contacting the plants. Dr. Moffitt and others can probably speak to this from kind of their side of the equation, and getting an update in terms of what's happening with that particular situation and working it towards resolution, whether it's a beneficiary issue, whether it's a provider issue. So each individual incident that is tracked to resolution is dealt with by staff. Then the contract managers are looking, again, at all the issues, but looking at it at a more systemic basis for what's happening with that their particular plan that they're responsible for. So we have a staff individual contract manager that's responsible for each contract with a managed care plan. So they're again looking at trends. Are there things in this particular with the health plan that I'm responsible for that are showing up? Does this again, compared to norms and benchmarks. So does this particular plan look like they have more issues going on with provider payment or providing accurate information to enrollees so that we can get triggers of where to look at compliance issues, where technical assistance might be needed, how we can work with that individual plan to address their specific issues. So we really have, and then again, as Kristen referred to, we meet as an implementation team and have for a couple weeks throughout MMA. We did this for long-term care, where every day we look at the complaints that have come in or issues that have come in, looking for systemic levels, right, kind of throughout a region or, you know, across the board with a rollout. So we really have those three different levels, you know, systemic, kind of the highest level, plan specific, and then individual instances, and we're kind of working different staff at different levels or working them all across the board.
It's Dr. Thacker. I had a couple of quick questions, and I assume, Kristen, that the system will be able to also track how well or how easily the system's accessed. For instance, I assume you'll be able to tell how many hang-ups you have or what the average length of the call is for resolution, what the wait times are, you know, what your high traffic, you know, volume is certain times a day and that sort of thing. Is that correct?
Right now, the centralized complaint tracking system, it's using, you know, the online form, and it takes in complaints or issues received anywhere else throughout the division. It's not operating at the current time like a centralized call center, and so we don't have that kind of metrics. We do have metrics about the speed to resolution, the different types of complaints and issues that we're receiving, and that sort of thing. But it's not tracking call times, wait times, because it's mostly getting things from either online or through other either other email addresses or other intakes of complaints and issues.
This is David Rogers. I'm sorry I was in transit, so I didn't hear all of that, but I think Kristen's right. The answer is no. But what it does, it's a little bit different than a call center because it's actually incorporating a lot of different sources. So Kristen mentioned the email box. So complaints that come in there get pulled out and into the hub. Some call centers either are enrollment broker, as they get complaints from beneficiary. The folks in the Fort Myers office pull those out of that system from that call center and put them into the hub. The agency has a complaint and information line. That's for the agency as a whole, which also deals with a lot of facilities issues and licensure issues. Complaints that come in through that mechanism are pulled out of that system or that call center system and put into the hub so that we get everything related to SMMC, again, long-term care, now MMA, into a single repository that we can, again, look at those trends from an overall perspective. So these different kind of call centers are happening, but the complaint hub is really a mechanism where we pull everything together to get a kind of a comprehensive look at what's going on.
Well, it's Dr. Thacker again. It certainly seems like a very good system, and you know, that would be obviously bells and whistles, but the question is just prompted from, you know, looking at the feds and you know, their rollout of ACA and sign up and all of this in trouble. And so, you know, just trying to be proactive. The second question is in regards to, would this be the preferred portal for providers to access and to make a claim, such as payment or referral? You know, as a primary care physician, I can't find a hand specialist or a pulmonologist, something like that. Would this be the preferred portal?
If a provider is a part of a plan network and has been unable to get resolution of an issue through the plan, yes, this is where we want to hear about any issues that providers or recipients or anybody is having with the managed care plans that are part of the SMMC program.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Kathy Moffitt. Just to underscore something that David Rogers said a moment ago from the perspective of the health plans, for those of us who are currently serving Medicaid beneficiaries and honored to be serving again in the MMA rollout, when we receive a call from our contract manager or from the agency, obviously this invites a degree of urgency and on the part of the health plans and a need to investigate the matter immediately, which is done. And the agency is always provides us with as much information as they have about the complaint at the time. Sometimes it is a specific provider-facing issue. Sometimes it's a beneficiary-facing issue. Sometimes it's both. But generally speaking, the request from the agency to the health plan is, please determine the issue, get to the bottom of it, resolve it, and get back to us as soon as possible. And that generally means for most of us in the health plans by the end of the day, if that's feasible, or certainly as soon as it can be resolved. But there is a tremendous amount of collaboration during that resolution. And once it's resolved, I am certain from experience that the agency then goes behind the health plan and checks to make sure that the issue has been resolved as well. On the health plan side, that also invites a separate and independent process improvement opportunity. It, you know, if something has not gone right, we assess it, we determine why, we implement a process to improve it if necessary. We track and trend that as part of our quality improvement process. So we never want to see a complaint, but when we get one, it's an opportunity for us to make sure it doesn't happen again. So all of those things are kind of happening in parallel and simultaneously.
Hi, this is Amy Guinan. I just had to share, my office actually was able to make use of the complaint form this week, and I have a colleague who was working with a beneficiary, and the colleague did a complaint, and the beneficiary did as well, and they both got quick responses. People were put in touch with who they needed to be put in touch with to work the issue out, so we're really pleased and excited about how that went. I did have one question, though, about you mentioned how complaints, if the person wasn't comfortable or didn't want to fill out the form, they could contact the area office. When they're going through the complaint process, is there a link to the area office information?
This is Kristen Sokolowski again, sorry. When you go online and click on report a complaint, there's the form, and on the bottom it says if you need help submitting this complaint, you can contact your area office, and there's a link that takes you to the area office phone numbers.
Okay, great. So, yes. And actually, it's probably due to just the overload of everything that's going on with Medicaid and the ACA, but we have had some complaints from people we work with who are having trouble getting into the local area offices when they called, or they would have to leave a message. So if that's the case, should they maybe try the complaint hub in Area 8, or should they keep sticking with the area, their local area office, and leave a message?
This is Kristen again. I would say if they are trying to report a complaint or issue and they can't fill out the form, is that the circumstance that you're...
Yes, and when they try to call the area office, they're having trouble getting through there. Should they call the complaint hub then in Area 8?
Yeah, this is David Rogers. One of the things that we've done, it really coming out of the long-term care role, is we learned a lot about our phone system. We knew a lot about our contracted partners and kind of their rates. In 2 days, our phone system will change so that right now they're segmented by each area office so that they will be, I'm not sure what the right term terminology is, but you'll call any number and it will get you to the next available agent. So there could be, and we have that experience in long-term care and in preparation for May 1st in MMA, we put this change into our phone system, and again, it should go live in 2 days, where rather than calling the local office, whether that's Tampa or Fort Myers or Alachua or Jacksonville, and getting busy, so if we have someone available around the state, they're going to answer the phone and wherever that person may be available.
Great. Thank you.
This is John Moyle. I'm an audience member. I just was wondering if you all have developed a system where you categorize the complaints and you put them in certain buckets. So one's about a provider, one's about quality of care, because I guess for the information to be useful, it seems like you need to have a system like that. I was just wondering if that was already in place or was being worked on.
Thank you. This is Kristen again. Yes, when we initially set up the complaint hub, we established different categories having to do with whether the issue was from a provider or a recipient, whether it was about payment or services or quality of care. As we've moved through the implementation of the program, we've refined that slightly just based on the types of issues that we're seeing. For example, I mentioned that in long-term care we had an issue about county codes being wrong in people in the system. That wasn't an issue category we had set up originally, but we added that as it became something that was becoming more prevalent. So we do, and we use them for reporting and also for to kind of watch the trends. And we've added new categories as they've become necessary, but we definitely do.
Mark Fontaine, Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse. Are you planning on publicly putting up the results of the complaints so that the public can see what people think about the health plans or the providers?
I actually didn't hear the question. I'm working on the microphone. So with that,
are you planning on posting publicly what
the people that have filed complaints have said about the health plans, the providers, et cetera, or at least a summary of those?
Certainly all of our intake is a public record. I don't know that we really don't have any plans to post it publicly. What we do plan on doing is we have a plan on posting the quality scores of the plan. So we are going to be coming up with plan report cards that will be posted. It may take some time for us to actually develop their grades. So information has to come in before we're willing to assign them a grade of an A or a B or a C or whatever it happens to be. Certainly the complaint hub, the information take in, yes, it's a public record, but we weren't intending to disclose it in terms of posting it out. It's an enormous amount of information. And we are, the next question that Mr. Fontaine had was whether that the information from the complaint hub would be included in the grade. And the answer to that, the short answer would be yes. The long answer is that ultimately issues are going to be raised through this complaint hub that would factor in potentially to the grade. So consumer satisfaction with the plans is definitely something we plan on incorporating into the grade. We feel like one of the big opportunities that we have here is to have the best customer service that we've ever had in the Medicaid program in Florida, and we're counting on the plans delivering that customer service, and the consumer satisfaction is something that we want to take into account. Provider satisfaction is something we want to take into account, and it's measured directly and indirectly. If a provider says, I can't deal with this plan anymore, pound sand, well, that's going to have an effect on the network. That's going to have an effect on the quality score of the plan, potentially. All of these things will factor in, either directly or indirectly. So the complaint hub reflects what's actually going on the ground and how well we as an agency are doing and how well the plans are doing, and that will be reflected in the grades.
Can I add that? Just that, I wanted to... Thank you, Justin. This is David Rogers. I thought it might be helpful to have the context around kind of overall public reporting, but also to say in terms of the complaint hub right now, the information, again, you have to understand what it's used for. So as we've talked about, we're really looking at issues broadly, not complaints, if it's the cork barking or whatever. So you have to put some context around the numbers. As Dr. Moffitt mentioned also, we're also tracking it through to resolution. So on provider payment, for example, with long-term care, we don't close the complaint out until we've looped back with the provider and figured out whether that ultimately that payment has been resolved. There's often a lot of lag time, which depends on the provider, again, possibly resubmitting claims information. It can be quite lengthy. So the kind of the numbers, if you will, from what we look at to manage the program implementation, can be a little bit difficult to read in the context of how one might think of them as complaints. So I think, again, the context of that broader quality reporting being there, but we use this information or this data in a very specific way to kind of identify program issues, and those are really two different kind of different things that we're doing with it.
Okay, seeing no further questions from the members as well as or comments or questions from the public, I'm going to turn the microphone over briefly to Beth Kidder, she's going to be introducing the next speaker.
Good afternoon. I'm Beth Kidder. I'm the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Operations and over the policy and quality areas. Had to restrain myself from jumping into the report card discussion, since that's my area. But it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Sue McPhee. Sue has not only served as our field office manager for a number of years in the Hillsborough County and surrounding area and has done a marvelous job there, but she has been a tremendous leader in our as we've changed our organization and implemented this statewide Medicaid managed care program. She has been not only a thought leader, but a change agent as we've moved through some of the changes. David has talked about the changes to the call centers. We've talked about our complaint hub. These are all major organizational changes for us, and she's been a big part of that. She is now taking a leadership role beyond her role as field office manager with helping to manage our plans. And we talk about not just contract management in the traditional sense of keeping the paperwork all in order for contracts, but actually managing the plans, managing all of their operations, make sure they're getting optimal performance and meeting all of our standards. And so she's taking a leadership role with that and on an ongoing basis. And part of that is to oversee the marketing area. And this is a new area for us. And Sue's going to tell you about what we've done. And then you've got a number of materials before you that you're going to talk about today.
Thank you, Beth. Yes, today I want to talk to you a little bit about marketing and what our approach is going to be toward marketing in the statewide Medicaid managed care program. Okay. Just a little bit of background to begin. During the 2011 Florida legislative session, I'm sure we all remember, that was the session when the statewide Medicaid managed care legislation was passed, and we were directed to create and implement the statewide Medicaid managed care program, of course, with two components, long-term care and managed medical assistance. Long-term care managed care contracts that were implemented last year in 2013 contained the existing limitations on marketing activities that existed in the prior long-term care or managed care contracts. Prohibited activities included discussing, explaining, or speaking to a potential member about managed care plan specific information other than to refer them to the agency's enrollment broker. Under the Managed Medical Assistance Program, managed care plans will be able to market to potential enrollees. So, what are the advantages? Why marketing? Well, two main areas are, one, promoting integration. The Affordable Care Act established the Federal Coordinated Health Care Office to ensure that Medicare and Medicaid enrollees have full access to seamless, high-quality health care and to make the system as cost-effective as possible. There was the alignment initiative of CMS, Medicare and Medicaid Coordination Office, is working to integrate Medicare and Medicaid programs by transcending the boundaries across the two programs, like separate and conflicting marketing requirements. So we're working toward an alignment of those requirements between Medicare and Medicaid. In July of 2013, CMS provided alignment demonstration marketing principles and guidance, building off the Medicare marketing guidelines to improve integration and marketing materials. The other major advantage of marketing is that it helps to promote quality. In an effort to improve the quality of care for Medicare beneficiaries, CMS developed a 5-star rating system for Medicare Advantage and prescription drug plans. And it allows more marketing privileges to those health plans with higher ratings. And those plans that have an overall 5-star rating have the option to include CMS's Gold Star on their marketing materials. Sponsors with an overall 5-star rating may market their ability to enroll beneficiaries through the 5-star special enrollment period. So let's talk a little bit about how marketing is defined. In the Code of Federal Regulations, marketing means any communication from a managed care organization, a prepaid inpatient health plan, a prepaid ambulatory health plan, or a primary care case management organization to a Medicaid beneficiary who is not enrolled in that entity that can reasonably be interpreted as intended to influence the beneficiary to enroll in that particular plan's Medicaid product, or either to not enroll in or to disenroll from another plan's Medicaid product. Marketing materials means materials that are produced in any medium by or on behalf of a plan and can reasonably be interpreted as intended to market to potential enrollees. Some of the other federal requirements that have been incorporated into the managed medical assistance contracts with our plans include plans are prohibited from distributing marketing materials without prior approval from the state. Marketing materials may not contain false or misleading information. Plans are required to distribute marketing materials throughout their contractually specified service area. And plans are prohibited from directly or indirectly engaging in door-to-door, telephone, or other types of cold call marketing activities. And cold call marketing is defined as any unsolicited personal contact by the plan for the purposes of marketing. Plans must also ensure that prior to enrollment, individuals receive sufficient information in a language and format that is easily understood to make an informed decision regarding whether to enroll in a particular plan. So in order to accomplish all of these things, we set about developing a process for the review of marketing materials for our medical managed assistance plans. The agency contracted with Mercer to develop a process for the review of managed care plan marketing materials, including developing review tools for both branding and written materials. We pulled together a team of staff in the Tampa field office who went through a day of training. David Rogers actually came down and provided a very comprehensive overview of marketing and the review of marketing materials for our staff. And then the review team members participated in a group review process where each team, led by staff in the office, Lorraine Campanero is here with me from our office, and she is actually going to be leading our marketing team once it's fully staffed. We completed the review team, a review tool for each item that was submitted by the managed care plans. We conducted second level reviews. If the team could not reach consensus or had questions about a particular item. So it was, and we did this purposely because we wanted to be sure that folks were able to review and discuss items and share and compare notes on their understanding of the contract requirements relating to marketing materials. And I think it was a really good exercise for us. We started out with branding materials that were submitted to us by the end of March, and we completed those reviews during the first 2 weeks of April and notified plans of results on April 14th. The results were compiled, and we're tracking them in a tracking log. Approved items did receive the agency approval stamp, and the managed care plans that did not receive approval on some of their items will have the opportunity to resubmit denied items for re-review with a due date for those items to be returned to the agency for re-review by May 15th. When we completed the branding materials review, we began reviewing written materials, broadcast scripts, and marketing scripts. And that review is going on now, and we are on track to complete that phase of the review by May 9th. Prior to approving other types of materials, the agency is requesting review by the Medical Care Advisory Committee members to determine if such materials raise any concerns with representatives of health professions who are familiar with the needs of low-income population groups and with members of consumers groups, including Medicaid recipients. We are, this big folder that's in front of you contains the materials that we have reviewed and approved through our team review, and we're asking for your feedback and review. Hopefully we are looking to get some feedback from you by May 2nd so that we can complete our review and send the approval notices on written materials to the plans by May 9th. Review and approval of promotional activities, nominal gifts, and permissible marketing events will occur before July 31st. The agency does plan to provide further guidance to the managed care plans on those marketing activities after this first phase of branding and written materials and scripts has been completed. The next page is...
Excuse me, this is Sarah Sequenzi on the phone. Can I ask a question, please?
Sure.
For the PowerPoint on the screen and the marketing materials in the large file in front of you, how will we get access to that information?
Carla Sims will be sending it out after the meeting.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So what we're looking at now is the process flow for the team's review of and the Medical Care Advisory Committee's review of marketing materials. So what we've done up to this point is the plans have submitted their materials. We have organized them and given them to the team for review. And then we have, at the team level, have reviewed them and decided which ones we believe meet the criteria in the contract and are ready to be approved. And then those that we saw did not meet the criteria in the contract and were not in compliance with all of the requirements, we have noted as denials. Some of the things that caused a denial would include items that were submitted in draft form with edits, notes, or formatting errors. What we found is that some of the materials were not submitted in final form, ready to print, so it was difficult sometimes to see whether or not they were actually, you know, ready for prime time and ready to be distributed. Marketing pieces sometimes were missing contractually required disclaimers. The contract does require that all marketing pieces contain a disclaimer that says that the managed care plan is a managed care plan with a Florida Medicaid contract, and that exact wording verbatim has to be on every marketing item that is submitted for review and approval. If the plan does list their telephone number, there should be an accompanying TTY number. Some of the materials that were submitted were missing that TTY number. Sometimes we would see a plan telephone number, but not a number for the agency's choice counseling office, so that folks could actually call to enroll. Some things were just placed in the wrong folder, and so we when we asked for the plans to submit branding materials in a folder named branding, we found that there were written materials or broadcast scripts in those folders that were placed there in error. So we moved them for later review in the next phase of the review. Some enrollee materials were. And provider recruitment materials were submitted for review as marketing, but since they are not actually marketing materials, those were not reviewed by the team. And then we did receive some materials that really are related to marketing events and nominal gifts, and of course that review is going to occur later in the review process, and so those we are just not reviewing at this time, and when we send further guidance to the plans, we will let them know what we need from them in terms of materials for that review and approval process. So, back to the process.
To comment, the deaf community really does not use the TTYs anymore. The majority of the deaf community now use video phones, and those that don't mainly text to communicate. So I believe that the deaf and deafblind communities are both working to ask all public agencies to upgrade to video phone or use text, allow the use of text messaging.
Thank you for that comment. We'll definitely make note of that. Back to the process flow. The materials that were reviewed and approved by the team are now being shared with the Medical Care Advisory Committee. And what we're asking is for the Medical Care Advisory Committee members to look at these materials and give us your feedback on whether or not you feel that there are any concerns with any of the materials that have been submitted by the plans. We would like to get your perspective on the materials that were submitted, whether or not you find any of the information that's presented or the wording on the materials confusing or misleading in any way, if there's any other concerns that you see as you review them. We'd be very interested in your feedback and your help in our making sure that the marketing materials are going to be helpful and meaningful to Medicaid recipients and potential enrollees. The last couple of pages of the presentation just kind of give you some of the definitions of the various types of marketing materials. We looked, of course, initially at branding, which is primarily marketing through mass communication in some form of print media, such as newspapers, magazines, billboards, with the purpose of influencing an enrollee to enroll and to contact the managed care plan for more information. The next two definitions actually are Medicare definitions of advertising and outdoor advertising. Again, materials primarily intended to attract or appeal to potential plan enrollees. Broadcast scripts include text, written text of messages transferred or transmitted to a large group of people by a managed care plan through mass communication media such as television, radio, or social networking. Marketing scripts include the standard text that a managed care plan staff would use in verbal interactions with potential enrollees, designed to provide information and or to respond to questions and requests that are intended to influence such individuals to enroll in the managed care plan. Scripts, again, the next two darker blue definitions are Medicare definitions of scripts and template materials. Scripts, of course, standardized text, and template materials are any marketing materials that include placeholders for variable data to be populated at a later time. Written materials for our review are printed informational material targeted to individual recipients which promote the managed care plan, including but not limited to brochures, flyers, leaflets, other printed information about the managed care plan. Written material includes materials for circulation by physicians, other providers, or third parties. So those posters you see in the doctor's office or those types of things. Community outreach materials are materials regarding health or nutritional information or information for the benefit and education of or assistance to a community on health-related matters or public awareness that promotes healthy lifestyles. Such materials are meant specifically for the community at large and may also include information about healthcare services, preventive techniques, and other healthcare projects, and the provision of information related to health, welfare, and social services or social assistance programs offered by the state of Florida or local communities. These are not always going to be marketing materials if they're not specifically providing information on how to enroll in the plan. They may be more geared to, again, the community at large to provide health-related information. Pre-enrollment marketing materials are, again, these are Medicare definitions, subset of marketing materials used prior to enrollment, and post-marketing materials, another set of materials used after enrollment. And that is concludes the PowerPoint. What we are hoping is that over the next 10 days that you will be able to take some time to go through the materials in the notebooks that we provided to you and provide us with some of your thoughts and feedback on the materials that have been submitted by the plans. These are all materials that we have reviewed and that we have found them to be in substantial compliance with the requirements in the MMA contract. So, but we are very interested in your feedback on whether or not you find any of this material to be in any way confusing or difficult or would be difficult for recipients in any way.
Hi, Chuck Corley. And there's a lot here and a lot of thought and expense and all went into the development of a lot of these materials, but it seems to me that most of them ultimately say, call this phone number. And I see that you've approved scripts and all this, but do you plan anything in terms of monitoring activities in this arena going forward, like secret shoppers or something, to find out what consumers are really hearing when they call that number?
Yes, we do.
I think Sue said it pretty well, which is yes, we do plan on doing that. Medicare does have a secret shopper program, and we do want to look at and see how they're doing it so that we're not reinventing the wheel as we do it. But one of the big goals that we have in this program is to, and it's a long-term goal, is to get better communication and better integration between the Medicare and the Medicaid program. And when it came to marketing, this is one of the areas where what we were requiring of health plans in the state of Florida was very different from what Medicare was doing. And so what we've tried to do, and Sue took you through the definitions, you'll notice from the PowerPoint that, in fact, most of those definitions are Medicare definitions, is we have tried to make sure that the health plans, who, by the way, usually have Medicare lines of business in our state in addition to Medicaid lines of business, that they have the opportunity, that they have they're following the same rules when it comes to their marketing, and that then will present an opportunity down the road for them to have members that they're reaching out to in the same way. Maybe they're dual eligible for both programs, and they'll have one plan that can give them their services and can coordinate their care. So that's the opportunity we're trying to see there. But yes, we do anticipate, and as part of our functional realignment, we do think that we're going to have a unit that is dedicated to overseeing the marketing process. Sue's going to be a big part of that, and the folks down in the Tampa St. Pete area are going to be a big part of that. And we do anticipate having secret shoppers similar to the Medicare program and trying to understand exactly what what the plans are doing and saying. One thing I can tell you about this particular area, this is one area where the plans will report each other and, on a significant scale. So we have to be prepared for that. And we have to make sure that when the plans report each other, because what they're saying is X plan is doing this. If they're allowed to do it, then I'm going to start doing it. That's what they're really saying. So it's important for us to have criteria that are understandable, that track what's going on in the Medicare program, so that they're not dealing with two different sets of regulations, but that aren't misleading consumers either. Dr. Thacker, you're recognized.
Thank you, Dr. Thacker. A comment and a quick question. It is generally my opinion that purchasing your health care insurance policy at a flea market on Saturday morning is not a good idea. And I don't know if we have any restrictions in that regard. I think also the further the comment is that many, if not all, the plans can or have utilized marketers that operate on commission, and I don't know if there's any restrictions of that, or I imagine that's a system that works, but also is inherently built into it to sign people up, and maybe that's not the best option for them. And my question in particular is, will the state, will ACA provide in the different regions a list of the individual or the other plans, so that a marketing plan, there in this area, North Florida, that encompasses Tallahassee, there's only two plans. It's either or. Of course, in some areas, I believe there's as many as 8 or 9 plans, if I recall. And so, is ACA putting out any printed material or anything to just let people know that these are all your plans? There may be one in particular plan, you know, and I've looked through this book and there's some slick marketing in there, and it's a lot of good graphics and things. But one or two plans may just dominate the market and people lose sight that, you know, you have 6 other plans that are probably very similar.
Sure. Well, first off, anyone that calls our choice counseling line and our numbers is not—they're not going to be directed to a specific plan. They're going to have an independent choice counselor that will inform them of all the choices that are available to them. That's whether they call in or whether they go onto our website, and they are going to have an opportunity to choose the plans. The type of information we would drive out during that process is what the network looks like primarily. And get an understanding of who's in their network and what types of services they cover, so that they can make a choice of what plan they think best fits them based on whatever healthcare consumption they've had in the past. So there are going to be plenty of opportunities for impartial, for folks to get to impartial people who understand all of the health plans available in a region and that can help assist folks figuring out who's in network, who's out of network, and pick the plan that's right for them, what the service coverages are, and things like that. So that's definitely there. And yes, we do, when we do communicate with enrollees and do let them know when their choice period is beginning and that they should call a choice counselor and that the choice counselor will help them through their choices. So for what it's worth, and now, David, you're recognized.
Yeah, I wanted to mention one, I think, pretty significant thing. There are some differences between Medicaid and Medicare that are very subtle, but there's one big difference in terms of marketing, and that is in the Medicare arena, agents, you know, representatives actually sign people up, and they enroll people into the Medicare products. And that is not how it occurs in the Medicaid environment. Plans can enroll people. They have to go through our enrollment broker. So there's that kind of independent, unbiased variable that is very different than the Medicare. Medicare, you can go out, an agent can go out, talk to you, you sign the forms there, you're enrolled in that plan. There is, again, there's a different kind of mechanics to how it works in the Medicaid arena. In fact, as we went out and did readiness reviews for plans, preparing for MMA and looked at their marketing plans, and let plans know, it can actually be counterproductive for them to be fairly aggressive with those agents. And we haven't approved any of that activity yet at this time. We're phasing this in kind of thoughtfully, slowly. We have had longstanding protocols in the enrollment broker, the choice counseling operations, that they won't enroll you in a plan if you have an agent present with you, for example, because we don't want undue influence, right, or people to feel pressured. So, again, there's some protections in there because Medicaid operates very differently from Medicare, which is a little bit more unfiltered between the agent just signing people up for the plans.
Thank you. And again, the marketing materials.
The marketing materials
are going to come through this committee. We want to get input on their marketing materials. They have to come through this committee.
In the marketing, is there any provision in this marketing so that somebody coming in to sign up will know who the providers are in the plan that they're signing up for? This is one of the complaints that I've heard in other states is a big problem. The participants sign up, but they have no idea who the providers are.
That goes back, I think, to the point that David made, which is that the folks that go out, if they talk face-to-face with a recipient, that's great, but they are not really in a position to enroll the person. In order to enroll, the person has to call our choice counseling line, and the information about who is in-network and who is not in-network, that is at the choice counseling center. And that brings us back to the complaint hub, which is that if you are finding, as advocates or as recipients or any stakeholder, or any member of the public, that in fact people are being listed as being in the network of these plans, but they actually aren't, that's very important for us to know because that's something that is actionable. We actually have in the contracts right now that it's a key part of the success of the rollout and ongoing that the networks be accurately reflected. But if someone is in network, the plans are being held to a standard in most parts of the state that 95% of the providers that they list as being in network, the physicians in particular, have to be accepting new patients. Not just that they are in network and under contract, but actually accepting new patients. From an enforcement standpoint, the easiest way for us to enforce that is if you guys are deputized and feel free to call us and go into our complaint hub and let us know when there's a problem because that's how we solve that. Secretary Corley, you're recognized.
Thank you. And I think David made a critical point when he pointed out or clarified that even though they've been visited or talked with a marketer from a plan, they will go back and have to go through a choice counselor without the marketer present in order to enroll. But in turn, will that choice counselor, let's say the consumer calls them and says, I'm ready to join a plan, I've already picked XYZ, will the choice counselor at that point say, well, may I ask why you chose that plan? Because they may hear something like, well, the marketer assured me they're negotiating with my physician and expecting a contract any day or something like that, you know, and there may be an indication for further counseling at that point.
I'm not sure that would be in the script right now for the choice counselor, but it's not a bad idea.
Robert Payne, following up on what Dr. White mentioned earlier, you know, about the enrollees having access to who is in whose network. Is there any way that from the AHCA side we can verify the veracity of the networks? Because I know there have been some problems in the past where people have been assigned a network and they were not accepting new patients or, you know, so forth and so on. So there really is a big problem about the accuracy, you know, of the networks.
That becomes a critical component of our contract enforcement with the plans. It's something that is really incumbent on our agency. And so we need as many eyes and ears on the ground as we can. Certainly our area offices are out there. Certainly we have folks that we can bring resources to bear to call provider offices and verify that they are in network or out of network. But the easiest way for us to figure that out would also be a complaint coming in from a recipient or from a provider saying, you know, I'm listed as being in this network and I'm not in this network. I will say that this area can get very murky in a lot of ways. We've certainly had experience where a provider has said that they are not in network and the plan has in fact been able to produce the contract that showed that the provider's office manager or whoever had signed them up for that plan, so that they can be in networks that they don't realize. But we are committed to verifying and making that a primary focus, that these networks are the broadest networks that have ever been available to Medicaid recipients going forward, that they are accurate, and that they form the basis for recipients to make accurate choices about which health plan that they want to be in.
Yeah. Robert Payne again. Following up on what you said, you had pointed out a case where there may be a provider who doesn't think they're in the network, but yet they're listed and have a contract. Well, that's a very good example of how someone may be in the network but not accepting new patients.
Yeah.
Because if he doesn't think he's in the network, he's probably not going to be accepting patients there either.
And I'll tell you, that is something, you know, this is Justin again, that's new to our program in the contracts right now, which is the idea that not only are you supposed to list someone as being in network, but there are contract standards about the percentage of providers that are listed in your network that are accepting new patients. So that's a new area for us. In fee-for-service, as well as in the managed care plans, we would have providers that were enrolled in our program fee-for-service, but that weren't accepting new patients. We would list them as being doctors that took Medicaid or that were enrolled with Medicaid. The health plans could list providers as being in their network, and yet when recipients would call, they would find out, well, our panel's closed, we're not taking any new patients. There are now contract standards, different from anything we've ever had in fee-for-service or in managed care, where a specific percentage in each region of the physicians, for example, listed as being in network have to be accepting new patients. And we have to enforce that. And again, we will bring resources to bear to that, but also we will be watching the complaint hub in the event that becomes a consistent concern with a specific health plan or in a specific region, and we will be imposing liquidated damages or sanctions on the plans for failing to meet a contract standard if it turns out that they're not meeting the standard that they agreed to in the competitive procurement.
Robert Payne, one more time. That's music to my ears to hear that from ACA's standpoint, that you'll be investigating the networks to make sure they're accurate.
Sam Whitaker, I have just one question on that. I think that's great, but some of the areas are so huge that the plans cover, and the percentage, is it for the whole coverage area of the plan, or is there some way like in my area, in Zone 2, you have several, a huge area. You know, you may have 5 or 10% of the providers there that take patients, but they may be 150 miles away from where that patient lives. Now, I know that's kind of, that's actually a realistic thing in my area. So is there something that addresses the locality?
Our network, there are geolocation requirements in our network adequacy standards, yes. So there are specific drive times and there are specific distances that we would be looking at to ensure network adequacy. Overall, historically, network adequacy in our program, particularly for managed care organizations, has been very different than what's going to come. And I've made this point before. In the past, if you wanted to have a managed care organization, you didn't go through a competitive procurement. If you had a licensed health plan, you could potentially come up in just one county. It was done county by county. And you could do it for a specific number of recipients. So you could say, I want to have a health plan, and I want to have it serve Leon County, and I want to have it serve up to 10,000 recipients. Well, when you put together a network, and our network standards generally only looked at primary care physicians, you start to see how small that network could potentially be to put that managed care plan together to serve the folks in Leon County, but only to serve 10,000 of them. And folks could potentially join that plan or be assigned to it and be very disappointed with the network that they found once they got inside the plan and understood who was there and who was actually taking patients. Going forward, the network adequacy requirements, really, for example, in Region 2, you have to have the ability, wherewithal with your network, to serve every single person in the region that's on Medicaid, about 100,000 people. That's the network you're building now. And the network isn't just in a single county. It is going to be region-wide, and there are going to be standards around drive times and geolocation.
Thank you.
Dr. Moffitt, you're recognized.
Just real quick, Kathy Moffitt, I thought it would be helpful to understand from the plan's perspective, as we have been getting ready to serve in implementation, one area of particular focus has been the plans actively engaging the provider networks and doing provider education. And as the agency has worked with the plans on implementation and readiness, they have asked to see our curricula and our schedules to meet with providers and to tell them about the new program and to make sure that they do know the new changes in benefits and the service level agreements and what's expected. So hopefully the provider community does know they're participating with the plans they are. They do know what's expected in terms of after hours and accepting new patients and what's expected of them in terms of efficiency and quality of care. That's been a particular area that the agency has asked all plans to focus on and to demonstrate. So it would be kind of hard for a provider network at large to sort of not know that they're participating with a plan in this program.
Dr. Thacker, you're recognized, and we're going to try to get so that there's plenty of time for the subcommittee, the subpopulation committees to meet. So one more comment. Like I said before, we're always open for public comment at the agency, so if you have any other questions, you don't hesitate to reach out to us. And I also will give one more opportunity for anyone who has any comments or questions about the marketing materials to before we move on. But go ahead, Dr. Thacker.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Dr. Thacker, looking through the marketing materials, and just to point out a couple of little things, I think it's always misleading when something says no cost. There's always a cost, and Magic Johnson is all over a bunch of these brochures. But one of the things I wanted to say is the one particular plan, it's called Clear Health Alliance. And so I had a couple of just quick questions about it. Is this a plan that is only for HIV and AIDS patients?
Yes, it is a specialty plan. It's available in 10 of the 11 regions of the state. And as an HIV-AIDS specialty plan, it is only open to folks that we can identify in our system as having HIV-AIDS.
So someone that presents their Clear Health Alliance card to, you know, the office when they're checking in or whatever, automatically, and I know we have HIPAA in place, but automatically someone knows that, well, this person has HIV or AIDS. The other thing is that on that particular promotion, the one for Clear Health Alliance, they're proud that they give the flu, pneumonia, and shingles vaccines for free. Shingles vaccines contraindicated for a patient with HIV AIDS. So they should not be receiving shingles vaccine, so they should probably eliminate that.
Okay. Thank you for that. Go ahead.
Yep. So I think we will get, this is David Rogers. So Carl will get an email out, so we'll make sure we get the materials and the PowerPoint out, particularly those who weren't there, and maybe provide some instructions. You have, I think, Sue's email. We'll get that out with the email also that you can provide the feedback. But it's a great opportunity. So Sue and Lorraine and their teams have done just remarkable work in going through applying the contract requirements. But this is a great opportunity for us to hear from professionals, from consumers. Again, that area of what's misleading, what's confusing, right? That's kind of a somewhat subjective area that, again, your input is very valuable to us before we move forward with this material. So we thank you in advance for your participation with that.
With that, Carla, go ahead and take it away, and we'll break out into the subpopulation committees.
Okay, it's time for the subpopulation committees. We are moving to other rooms for these activities. Okay, the meeting will adjourn from your subcommittee. The next meeting of the Medical Care Advisory Committee will be July 29th, so plan to be here for that. The Medical Care Advisory Committee is adjourned, and the subpopulation committees will begin.